Transmission start. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Join us as we wander off the path and explore lost history, consciousness, the paranormal, unexplained mysteries, alternative thought, and much more. We are present on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now here is your host, Soraya.
Greetings and welcome to this edition of Where Did the Road Go? Tonight we're going to be talking with Grant Cameron, who has a book out called Charlie Red Star. And this is a weird UFO that repeated for quite a while up in Canada. And he wrote this book back in the 1970s or so and never published it, and is only publishing it now. It's a very interesting case, but I found that his views on this stuff have changed a lot, and that was kind of cool. It became a very interesting conversation. Interestingly, talking with Sherilee Black, who is up from that area, she said that one of the things she found interesting about the whole Charlie Red Star thing was how quickly people seem to forget about it. She said she can remember her parents leaving with them her and her brother with a sitter to go out and see the lights, and their parents remember nothing about this whatsoever. It's kind of strange. You would think you would remember something about that. She said her mom doesn't remember complaining about all the, quote, nuts blocking the country roads looking for this thing. No memory of the news coverage, like nothing ever happened. That's as strange as the events itself. I don't know what to make of that exactly. Anyway, I do want to thank some of our new Patreons. Let's see, we had, I don't want to screw up anyone's name. Mary, with an E at the end. I don't know if that's just pronounced Mary. Daniel, Shannon, and Thor. So thank you guys for joining in to be a patron for the show, and thank you, of course, to all patrons out there, as well as everyone listening. This show would not be what it is without you guys and girls and everyone in between. So here's my conversation with Grant Cameron. The next 2 weeks, we're going to have Jack Brewer on. If you're a Patreon, you already have that conversation because it's a fairly long one, and it's going to be broken into two parts. The full thing was released to patrons, and here's Grant Cameron. Welcome to the show, Grant.
Well, thanks for Soraya, and thanks for your interest in what I'm doing.
So you have published a book that you wrote back in the 70s called Charlie Red Star.
That's correct.
And this almost never saw the light of day. This has been in limbo for over 30 years now, right?
Correct. That's been basically the history of my road down this path, is that majority of the things that have happened really had nothing to do with me. I wrote the manuscript. Nobody wanted to publish it. The local publisher who should have published it, because it was a big story back in 1975, said, "Mr. Cameron, you may believe in this kind of stuff. Count me among the unbelievers." And I was horrified. So I gave the manuscript to my sister, who's like the family historian. And I had even forgotten. I knew I had done some chapters, but I didn't realize the whole book had been done. And maybe 30 years later, she came back and said, "Remember you gave this to me?" And I looked at it and I went, whoa. And it was in the days when you had optical scanning, where you could scan it into a digital form. And I thought, well, I might as well just scan it into a digital form. And then a TV producer in Toronto, Canada, was trying to sell a Peruvian UFO story about the Rama Group, if you're familiar with them. Mm-hmm. Couldn't get it financed, and was looking for a Canadian angle, and said, "Well, can I read your manuscript?" And I said, "Yeah, sure." And then she was fascinated with it, and she was going to do this idea where this thing starts, where in Carmen, Manitoba, where this whole thing happened. And then this guy suddenly gets the inspiration to go to Peru. So she was able to finance it. And it was actually that producer who negotiated to have the book published. It never would happen if it had been up to me. She wanted it published to coincide with the movie. So she went through two promotions and actually was the one that got it published.
Wow. Okay. Well, I'm glad she did. This is a... There's some interesting stuff in this case. Now, this was something you had that happened up in Manitoba, right?
Yes.
And you had just sort of heard about it and decided to go check it out and see if you could actually see this recurring UFO.
Yeah, I had no interest that I can recall in UFOs, extraterrestrial phenomena. I was interested in weird stuff. I was interested in Edgar Cayce And I had, when I was at university, I had done a full term paper on dying patients in hospitals. So I'd gone to the chaplains and I'd asked all the weird questions like, does anybody ever predict their death? Does anybody ever come and visit somebody before they die? And that was when near-death experiences were first starting up. So I was asking that question and I put that together. And my sisters used to identify me as their weird brother. So I was into weird stuff, but never UFOs. And the only reason I went was because it was a big story in the, I live in a big city of about 700,000 people, and it was a big story. So I said to my friend, you know, we drove around the city and didn't do anything. I said, instead of driving around the city, why don't we go and see what everybody's looking at? And my friend said, yeah, okay, we'll do that. And we didn't do it. We didn't do it. It was February it started. And it wasn't until May of 1975. There's a local TV. There's a bunch of TV networks who were trying to film this thing. They were out there with all the people on the back roads and stuff. And one of them managed to catch this thing on the ground, and this thing jumped off the ground, and this cameraman just happened to push the trigger as this thing jumped off the ground. It was very, I thought it was random at the time. Now I think it was pretty synchronistic. But he, when this thing came out, then I said to my friend, well, let's go. Let's go see what they're looking at. And the way I always describe it is you buy the lottery ticket, you know there's a chance you can win, but you know you're not going to win. And we went out, and I went there, and we drove into town, out of town, into town, out of town. And after an hour, my friend, who I have coffee with every week, still have, and his life didn't change. Mine did. He said, okay, we'll drive back into town, Carmen, one more time. And if we don't see anything, let's go home. I said, fantastic. This has been a total waste of time. So we were driving into town. And then I was described like any sort of paranormal phenomena. I learned this lesson very early on. If you have not seen it, you can either believe or disbelieve, and that really doesn't count for anything. But if you see it, you know. And we were sort of looking around and we were saying, well, what are they looking at? You know, we're looking at planets and stars, and I knew nothing about astronomy, but whatever they were looking at didn't look very impressive. But when it appeared coming from the left, and it was an object, it was not a light in the sky, it was an object down low, very low to the ground, maybe 100, 150 feet in the air, maybe half a mile down the road, flew right in front of the car. And I say, you know, when you see it, you know. And nobody in the car said, well, is that what they're looking at? I wonder if that's what. Everybody just went, there it is. Everybody just instantly knew this is what they were talking about. It was just so bizarre. It wasn't even flying in a straight line. It was sort of bobbing up and down like a bobber on a fishing line. And I remember it was very, very low, and it was going in behind a set of school buses. And I remember the car was still moving, and I was getting out of the car because I wanted to run across this parking lot to see this thing because it was going to get behind these school buses. And my life just sort of I sort of fell off the edge of the earth, as I described it. The rest of the people in the car, nothing really happened to them. They just went on with their life. I dragged all my friends out two nights later. And after an hour, they said, oh, we're going home. And I said, no, you got to see this. I was just, you know, you got to stay. And they said, no, we're hungry. We're going back for pizza. And they took off, and there was two cars, about eight people. And the second night, it flew right at us, and it came right in close. It was really, really close to us. And then I started to wonder, why is nobody covering this? To me, this seemed like a pretty significant event that was going on, and nobody seemed to be talking to people. And so that's why I put the manuscript together, and then just sort of was blown away when nobody would publish it. I just thought it was great. And then I had a synchronistic event again where my father is a pilot for the Canadian government. He was with the Department of Transport. And then he just happened to say, as this manuscript was rejected, there's this guy, Ernie Epp. He said, Ernie had a sighting. Go talk to him. So I went, and it was just an ordinary sighting, just, you know, light in the sky type thing. And he said, you know, if you really want to know what's going on with UFOs, you should study what the Canadian government was doing in 1950 to 1954. And I said, oh, really? And he said, yeah, I worked for the guy. And there was actually five or six people on this organization that ran this program for the Canadian government. And I just happened to run into one of them who lived in Winnipeg, like 1,500 miles away. It was just so bizarre. And that started me down this path of trying to figure out what I'd seen. I knew the sighting thing wasn't all that important, but I knew somebody in the world had to know what that was. Somebody in this world had to have the information, the intelligence to have figured this thing out. And so that was the rest of my career, 42 years, where I just basically ran around trying to find out what the answer was. And the answer came to me in this bizarre download experience in 2012. But the sighting thing got me going. I mean, I thought it was random at the time, and now I look back and say, you know, I wonder, because if it hadn't been for that film, that TV crew, I never would have gone out, because we were just sort of delaying. We didn't do it. And it was almost like, you need to come out. And so I've never heard of a UFO getting caught on the ground where it gets filmed jumping off the ground. And it was very bizarre. And it's almost like they needed me out there. So they staged this whole landing thing where they allowed themselves to be filmed as they jumped off the ground. I see it completely differently now than I did in 1975.
Yeah, well, that's good. I mean, if we don't progress with our views, we're really not going to get anywhere. Why do you think it was... I mean, you don't normally see UFO sightings. You get flaps of UFOs, but you don't see them like this, where this thing followed the same path over and over again.
Well, it was actually more extensive. I had to cut some of it out of the manuscript. It was going on in North Dakota. There wasn't that many researchers. There's no researchers in North Dakota at the time, but it was also going on in Minnesota and in Wisconsin. So there was a line of sightings down. And the other thing that was, and I'm pretty sure it's in the book, is 1975 was my first sighting, took place 2 weeks after the end of the Vietnam War. And I never knew why Manitoba was a small town, because there was nothing in this town. It was just absolutely nothing. It was just farm fields. And most of the people who saw this stuff saw it in 75, 76. The main guy who ran the airport there, he was a famous aviation guy. I asked him, I said, 30 years later, I was going to lecture on it. And I said, Bob, why were they here? And he said, well, you know why they're here. And I said, no, I don't know why they're here, Bob. And he said, I told you in 75 why they're here. You know why they were here. And I said, no, Bob, in 30 years, I have no idea why this thing was here. And I said to him, how many sightings did you have, Bob? And he said, 100, but 150. And I said, how many have you had since 1976? And he said, none. It was like in this 2 year period. And so what I learned 30 or 35 years later was the fact that, number one, all the SAC bases, all the Strategic Air Command bases, Air Force bases along the Canadian-U.S. border, according to NORAD documents, were being visited. And the UFOs were inside the nuclear weapons storage areas, like Loring, Wurtsmith, Minot, Malmstrom, all these bases along the Canadian border. And all these sightings were going along in the same period, like through Minnesota and Wisconsin. Wisconsin had one town that was so bad, the CIA actually sent two people there to investigate what was going on in this town. So it was sort of a bit more extensive, but I think ours was very, very heavy. And then I learned that in this February, the sighting started on the north side of the border where I am in February of 1975. And it was later that I found out that February 1975, the Americans started the only anti-ballistic missile unit that ever went operational in the United States. This was pre-Star Wars. When Reagan was in, he put the stuff in outer space in the attempt to shoot down the Russian ICBMs. Mm-hmm. And most people don't realize that the number one target of the Russians is not Washington or New York or anything like that. It's the missiles in North Dakota, because unless you take out the missiles in North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, Wisconsin, you're not going to see what happens after that. So they put this thing in a town called Nakoma, North Dakota. It's just south of the border, just directly south of this town that was sort of, these UFOs were all over the place. And they installed 100 new nuclear missiles. There was already 300 Minuteman nuclear missiles in North Dakota, but they put in 100 new ones. And this was pre-Star Wars. This was an attempt to try to shoot down the ICBMs in outer space, these big 5-megaton missiles that they put in there. And then if that one missed, then they had these one-megaton missiles that would try to get it as it was coming in into North Dakota. And they started taking them out in 1975 in November. And that's when the sightings went away. So it was this period of time when they had put in this new anti-ballistic missile unit in Nakoma, North Dakota, with these big giant arrays where they were tracking Russian activities and stuff like that. And that seemed to be the key. But the other thing I thought was, I mean, if there's a telepathic connection to this thing, which I think there is, that it appears that all these non-human intelligences are telepathic, that they're basically one step ahead of us. They know what's going on. One of the things that I had sort of proposed was that they had lost the Vietnam War in the United States. And if you remember back in the 1970s, it was the domino theory. So the whole thing was the communists were taking over countries one at a time. And so the idea was, when we lost Cambodia, Laos, and South Vietnam, we had pulled all the troops, so we had no troops on the ground in Southeast Asia. And the idea was, according to what I thought, was that maybe they put these missiles on alert because they were sitting there waiting for the Russians and Chinese to make their next move. Are they going to take the Philippines? Are they going to try to take Indonesia? Which country is going to fall next in the dominoes? And these I was thinking maybe these weapons were all put on alert because all the bases were visited in 1975. And maybe that was what it was we have no troops in Southeast Asia. So the only way you're going to stop the Russians from taking the next country is to use nuclear weapons. And it may have been that the intelligence picked up on the fact that these weapons were on alert. We didn't know, but that they were thinking about using these weapons.
Okay. Talk a little bit about the, well, first of all, why did they name it Charlie Red Star?
It was just a woman in town. There was a number of people there who would spend almost every night. There was a photographer. She would be out every night trying to get it. And there was another woman. And this woman was a woman who basically thought she could control the weather and stuff. She was, she had lots of sightings. She would be out all the time as well. And she just wrote a poem about an Aboriginal hypothetical Chief Charlie Red Star. And that's so that sort of caught on. And then it even went as far as the newspaper, the little newspaper in the town would advertise and say shop for Charlie Red Star shops. And the name just sort of caught on. There was other objects other than Charlie Red Star. Charlie Red Star was basically, according to people, when they caught this thing on the ground, the TV crew, they went very close with some cars. And that's what sort of forced it to jump. And the pilot editor who got very close said he described the object as 50 feet high, about 15 feet, 50 feet long, 15 feet high, blood red, sitting in this field like a drive-in movie screen on like a 45 degree angle, but not touching the ground. So Charlie was one, but I had a number of objects that started to appear in 1976, which are different triangles, small orb type objects on the ground, maybe 11 miles east of the town. And so there was a variety, but Charlie Red Star was the one that sort of became famous.
Now, how much of this book did you alter before you published it, like from back then to now?
I put in the nuclear weapon thing. I didn't know that until just recently. They wanted to cut. It was 120,000 words. I had to cut it to 80,000 words. So I cut that out. And then the major thing we did is we changed every name in the book. None of the names are in the book because they wanted me to give a release from all the people who had been quoted in the book. And I said, well, that's absolutely nuts. Most of these people are dead. Right. And when I was doing the interviews, that was the last thing these people wanted to do. I mean, 75 was completely different than it is now. Now it's not as toxic an issue. But in 1975, you're in some little tiny small town. And the last thing they wanted was to be put on the record as having seen some UFO in their backyard or whatever. And so some of the families that went public were totally ostracized. So I changed all the names because there was no way I was going to get a release from everybody in that book.
Some of the formations, as you said, you saw triangles. There was also the Ferris wheel.
Yeah, that was the main family saw that. That was a main family who was about 8 miles north of town, and they had real bizarre stuff. Lost 32 horses, claimed that he was getting, and that was big money in those days, $700 a month of hydro was being pulled off his line. They had this Ferris wheel that they would see. They would have these objects follow them down the road. They had one land in their yard, and they didn't see the beings, but they could see shadows moving underneath this craft. And so that was the family that sort of tipped everybody else off, is that when they reported this, the fact that they had lost the 32 horses, they were just totally ostracized. The mother would say that when she went in the post office, and it was a small town, people would see her and just totally walk the other way. And so that was why nobody wanted to come forward, because they didn't want to end up in the same situation as these people that were, they almost like they were in the center of the hurricane. It was mostly north of the town, the really heavy, weird stuff that was going on north of the town.
Now you talk about like some of the lights would light up the entire area, and others you call dead lights, where they didn't really emit. They were kind of like luminescent, but they weren't lighting anything up around them, which is very strange.
Yeah, well, that is described if you look at UFO literature, and I didn't know this until years later, because I spent a lot of my time now dealing with experiencers, because you really can't tell much from lights in the sky. But if you talk to people who claim that they're interacting with the intelligence behind the phenomena, there's quite a few of them. There's about 4,000 of them, and a lot of them have have filled out this survey of 600 and some odd questions. And so a lot of them will describe in the ship, they'll describe, like, for example, there's a light on in a room and the light stops at the door. It doesn't go into the next room. It's just very bizarre. Like it's like contained light. And that's when the closest time I ever got to it is when I noticed this phenomena. And it was this small object that was on the ground. And it was sitting on this bridge, and I got within about 50 feet of it. And I can still to this day remember the bizarre nature of it, is that it was so bright that I had an 8mm movie camera that was running, and my friend had the binoculars. And you couldn't look at it with binoculars. It was so intense and so bright. And I was maybe 50, 60 feet away, and I was ready to jump. I was going to jump on it. And I remembered it was 2 inches. It was sitting on this wooden bridge, and it was 2 inches from the edge of the bridge, which had wooden railings on it. And it did not light up. It just a slight orange glow on the railings. And I was just going like, why is it not lighting up the bridge? It should light up the whole entire countryside. It was just so bizarre being so close and to see this. And so it was like we called it a dead light, but it's a self-contained light. But a lot of experiencers have described this phenomena on board the ship.
Hmm. Okay. Now, if I'm not mistaken, there was only one case in the book where someone actually encountered a being by one of the ships.
Yeah. What people don't realize in ufology is what happened then doesn't happen now. What happens now doesn't happen then. The field of ufology, I've been in it for 42 years, and I basically maintain that they're basically turning the pages of a book that we really don't realize that there's this changing pattern. So in that time, this is like a close encounter of the third kind where this fellow, and this is north of maybe 20 miles north of Carmen, where the main stuff was taking place. And this is a guy who sees this light in the field. He's with his girlfriend in a truck, and he leaves the girlfriend in the truck, and he walks out to see this thing. And he's looking for the door, and he actually sort of walks around this thing, gets to the other side, and then realizes the craft is now between him and the truck where his girlfriend is, and then backtracks, comes back around, and gets in the truck, and as he's backing out onto the road, his lights go through the ditch, and there's this little guy with a rod, and his girlfriend freaks out, and he just basically drives her home about a mile or 2 miles or whatever. It just pushes her out of the truck and goes racing back, and this thing is up in the air, and later the RCMP investigate it. But what's significant about that is those types of sightings where there are little beings, you know, wandering around picking up rocks and plants and stuff doesn't happen at all anymore. It just doesn't occur. Same as there are almost no sightings anymore of ships with light with windows in them. Or in the book, I have a whole chapter on what are called landing trace cases. And you'll always hear people talk about, oh, this is, you know, concrete evidence, and it proves that UFOs are real because they leave they kill the whatever crop they've landed in and leave these three tripod marks. Well, that hasn't happened for 20 years. None of those things have happened. There was piles of them back in 1975. There was no crop circles in 1975. There was cattle mutilations. That was the highest year for cattle mutilations. But cattle mutilations really don't occur anymore as well. It's almost like it's this bizarre phenomena. And now you have these, what you have is these experiencers who are getting these flashbacks and being on the ship and stuff. That really didn't happen much in 1975. I only had the one case that I was pretty well convinced this kid had been abducted. And that was the most dramatic interview I'd ever done in my life. And that was the story of this little 7-year-old boy who was very small for his age, had been urinating off the porch of his house. They had no inside plumbing. And he was with his horse, which is named Sunny. And this object appeared over a tree, which was about 50 yards from where this boy was. And this kid was suffering nosebleeds, very traumatized. They had to pull him out of school for a number of days. But his mother believed it was the devil. And so there was no way they were going to allow me to interview this kid. But the father was determined that I was going to talk to this kid. He was going to get to the bottom of this thing. And so they brought me in surreptitiously one Wednesday night to interview this kid. And I can still remember going into the room, and he was hiding behind a chair on the other side of the room. And his father said, you come out, tell Mr. Cameron, you tell him what you saw. And then the kid just peered out from behind the chair, didn't move. And then his father started to tell the story, come tell him this. And the kid never moved. The father basically told the entire story, how this little kid, the parents weren't home at the time. He was trying to get his older sister. He got this rifle. He was determined. He never shot a rifle before in his life. And he was a small kid. The rifle was probably as big as he was. And he was going to shoot this thing. And so when the whole story was done, the kid was still hiding behind this chair. And I got on the ground. I can still remember to this day. I got on the ground, in the middle of the room, and I put this piece of paper on the floor, which had all different types of UFO shapes on it or whatever. And I said, can you tell me what it looked like? And then he peered out and he crawled out from behind the chair and he took one look and he said, that one there. And he pointed to like a classic saucer with a dome on it. And I said, was it big? And he went, big as a house. And I said, what, did it have lights on it? Lights all over it. And I went through this whole procedure and how that turned from all different colored lights to white lights. And then I went on the road. And then I said, did it disappear or did it fly away? Disappear. Did it go out like a light? Out like a light. And that kid was traumatized. But I'm pretty sure that kid was probably an abduction. But because his mother had this very negative view, I figured the kid may have grown up, because he would be in his like in his 50s now, close to 50 years old. And I figured there was no point going back because he may have followed his mother's footsteps. And I did get other people that would come later and tell me these bizarre abduction type stories. And the one was very bizarre, because the one I told you about on the road where I was 50 feet away was 2 miles west of a town called Sperling. So this guy came to me 35 years later and said he had these abduction things, and he was the dreams and the screen images and the whole nine yards. And I said to him, I said, well, where was your house? And he said, 2 miles west of Sperling. I said, 2 miles west of Sperling? Are you kidding me? And I was like, I had spent like a year on this road south of where he was, but this guy would come 30 years later and tell me he lived on that road and he was having these experiences. So it was very bizarre. It did prove conclusively that there really was something to this, and basically set me off on this road to find the answer to what were these people seeing.
You had a very interesting interaction with one shining a flashlight at it.
Yeah, that was, again, that was these small, we called them ground lights. And then when I was put in contact, this friend of my father's in the Department of Transport put me in contact with the people who ran the Canadian government program. The guy who had run it was actually a contactee. The guy who ran the Canadian government program was actually in contact with an alien by the name of AFA, full-fledged contactee. They were doing the channel, the automatic writing. His wife, I went to talk to his wife, and she set me up with a guy who lived in the area who happened again to have worked. He was one of these six people that worked on the program. And I remember going to him, and he was very upset. He said, this ruined my life. He was a metallurgist who worked for the Canadian government, who had done, the Americans were sending a lot of material into Canada, like metal material. And he was the guy who did all the analysis. And I said, how much did you handle? And he said, lots of it. It was coming in all the time from the Americans. And so I mentioned to him, because he was in the area, and I said, well, we got these lights on the ground, these ground lights. And I described it, and he said, oh, you mean monitors? And I went, yeah, monitors. I had no idea what he was talking about. And basically he said, we had those back in 1950, in the 50s as well. They'd sit on the windowsill, and they would monitor what we were doing. They were following us around. And then I went back to this guy around the Canadian program. I talked to his wife, and sure enough, she confirmed these things were there, and they were in the yard, and everybody would see these things. But I would take little kids. I was taking tours, and in the end, I just basically said, "I'm tired of this," because everybody would say, "Oh, it's a light on the end. It's a car coming down the road." And I'd say, "Okay, how long do you think it's going to take to get here?" And they'd say, "Oh, 5 minutes." So I'd say, "Okay." 10 minutes later, I'd say, "Still think it's a car?" No, then it's a farm light. And we'd go through this same nonsense every time. And then we got to surround it. Let's go surround it. And the thing was always one step ahead. It knew what you were doing. So in the end, I basically gave up. But I had one very dramatic encounter. Which actually involved a federal police force in Canada. So I'm driving with these kids, and these big triangles are flying around, and I've got a kid in the front seat, and he's taking notes, and he ends up working for the mayor of Winnipeg, a fairly high level position. And he's taking the notes, and then I see one of these ground lights or these monitors down a different road. I've never seen it there before. So I took one kid out of the back seat. There was three kids in the back seat. And I said, look at this. And I flashed the light at it, and you'd flash three times, and it would flash back three times. You go side to side, and it would fly back and forth like a leaf going back and forth across the road, up and down. It would go up and down. And the kids, oh, he's all excited. And I said, well, go back, and I'm going to take your brother out. And I pull his brother out, and I flash at this thing three times. And that was the only time I ever heard a noise. We never heard noise except for that one time. And what it was, the description is, it was like a Morse code, but it was like a whistling noise. It was like a beeping whistling noise. And I just, absolute fear, that I, there's no way you can describe the fear that overcame me. It was just like, oh my goodness, this, we've bugged this thing, and now the people from up top are going to come. And I looked up on the American border, and there was this giant arc welding light, just very intense arc welding light. And I didn't know what to do. I was panicked. I took the kid. I said, let's go back to the car. And I sat in the car, and it made this sort of turn. It went along the American border, and then it started coming north towards our road, and I'm going, don't turn down. And the thing started to turn, and as it turned, it changed from this arc welding light into this triangle that we'd seen earlier in the night, with two huge red lights and a green light in the back. And I remember I was so scared, I said to the kids in the back seat, I said, give me my binoculars. And I actually had to hold the binoculars against the inside glass of the car, because my hands were shaking so bad. And I looked up as this thing hovered right above the car, and it covered the entire field of vision. So it was either very big or very close, and it was there, these huge lights. And I remember and this is described a lot in UFO literature as well, it's sort of like everything stops. I remember the kids were yelling and screaming in the back seat, but it's almost like time stops. And then it was almost like they cut the film, like if you get a jerk in the film, this thing was there, and there was this jerk, and it sort of moved just the slightest little bit, and the fear instantly went away. It was very, very bizarre. It just absolutely was gone. And this thing started to fly away, and suddenly the Royal Canadian Mounted Police pulled up in behind me, because we were in the middle of some road in the middle of nowhere, and I guess he wanted to find what was going on, so he pulled up. And then I said to the kids, I said, watch, I'm going to get them, because they had been on the record, and they didn't want to get on the record as having been involved in this. So he rolled down the, I rolled down the window, he shined the flashlight, and he said, so what's going on? And I said, see that object there? And he looked, and it was clear as day. You could still see this triangle flying away. And I said, oh, we're watching these lights down at the end of the road. And he said, what lights? And I said, well, turn off your lights, I'll show you. So we get out, and the kids are all excited, and they're jumping around. And that's when I took the flashlight, and there was nothing there. It was completely black. And I go, oh, you need, just when you need it. So I put the flashlight up in the air, and this thing rose up into the air, went back down again, side to side, and this thing went back and forth. And he looked, and then he said, oh, it's probably just a couple of guys at the end of the road having a beer. And I said, well, we've been following it for 6 miles now. And I guess he suddenly, because this story of me on the bridge where I was going to jump on this thing had been written up on the paper. And I guess he suddenly realized, triangle in the sky, light on the ground, this guy's, you know, he's flashing stuff. And they suddenly realized who I was. And he said, okay, I guess we'll see you guys. And he starts going towards his car. And I said to the kids, get his license plate number. Then he started to run. He jumped in the car. And this is a federal police officer. And he starts, the gravel's flying. He's running down the road. And these little kids are running with flashlights to get his license plate number as he took off. So it was pretty exciting times. There was a lot of, that was the only time it actually got fearful too. Most of the time it was sort of very playful. We'd actually chase this thing a number of times. You could, and it would move so slow you could actually catch up on it. And there would be people all over, like kids drinking beer on the side roads and stuff. But there was a lot of people who were involved in this and saw it. And it was only the one time when it turned on us and suddenly it was different. Instead of us chasing it, it was chasing us, and completely different game.
So what did the Canadian government have to do with all of this? You said that you were told to look in that direction.
Well, this was a synchronistic thing where it just happened this guy in my father's office had worked for them. And so I flew to Ottawa when I heard that the guy said to me, said, oh, this guy was the most brilliant engineer I ever worked for in my life. But he was totally nuts. I mean, he was talking to aliens and they were landing in his backyard. And I went, they were what? And of course, now I'm looking for the answer. I'm going, they were landing in the backyard. And so I flew to Ottawa, and I was very young at the time. I was still in university. So I flew to Ottawa to talk to this guy. The guy had died in 62, and he had the famous Canadian. He's the guy that wrote the famous Canadian government top secret memo. It's one of the most famous, highly classified UFO documents there is. And what had happened was this guy ran Radio Ottawa in Canada, which was the NSA of Canada. They were trying to pick off Russian communications. He was in charge. That was his security clearance. Plus, he was the head radio engineer for the Department of Transport, but he was fascinated with UFOs. So when he was negotiating FM radio station frequencies in the early 50s in the United States, in meetings, he would ask the Americans through classified channels. He'd go through the military liaison at the Canadian embassy, and he wanted to know from the Americans, what's the deal on flying saucers? And he writes this famous November 1950 top secret memo that says, I was told by American officials, flying saucers exist. It's the most highly classified subject in the United States, rated 2 points higher than the hydrogen bomb. There's a small group headed by Dr. Vannevar Bush that's trying to figure out the modus operandi, and it's of tremendous significance to the Americans. And then when I have the download experience in 2012, the next line of that document is put into my head. And the next line of the document says, and we were also told by American officials that other things might be associated with this with the phenomena, such as mental phenomena. And the Americans aren't doing very well because they've said if we're working on it, they're willing to exchange credentials and talk to us. And the key to that was in 1950, nobody was talking to aliens. Adamski and Williamson, these contactees, would not appear until a couple of days after the detonation of the hydrogen bomb. Betty and Barney Hill, the first abduction case, would not be released until 1966. In 1950, nobody's talking to aliens, and nobody knew aliens were telepathic. And already in this document, the Canadians knew that mental phenomena was connected to flying saucers. So Wilbur Smith had run this program, and he was in contact with this alien by the name of AFA. So was the CIA, so was the FBI, so was the US Air Force. I would learn this all later. But when I went to talk to his wife, I remember picking her up and going to her son's place, because they had stashed away all the files. He had second copied all the files, and the son was keeping these files, so we went to his place. And it was bizarre just listening to this woman, who was secretary to the Speaker of the Senate in Canada herself. She was not a low-level person herself, talking about the fact that they were in contact with this alien by the name of AFA, and that they were going to land it at a base, an army base in Suffield, Alberta. And a lot of this stuff I would later confirm with other testimony and with documents, that the Canadian guy, this Canadian guy was very much into the thing and believed it and was in contact with this alien. And that in August of 1954, he actually had a station set up on military property where he had a flying saucer observatory, had five different instruments to detect a flying saucer. And what happened was he detected something coming over, and it went right off the charts, and they went out and it was overcast. So he went, and it was public. He went public to the newspaper and said, if there's nothing wrong with the equipment, we've just detected the first flying saucer over Ottawa, which is the Canadian capital. And that was it. They shut the program down, and that was the end of that. But it was that investigation that led me to find out where did he get this top secret material, and that's what led me to the President of the United States and, you know, Dick Cheney and CIA people and all that kind of stuff. And then it all sort of fit in that there was answers, there were people who knew what it was going on, and then I had the download experience, which came with absolute certainty, which said, it's consciousness. It's non-local consciousness. That's the basis of this whole thing.
Do you want to go into that a little bit? Like, what happened?
Well, I was chasing the president. I had my couple seconds of fame. I had actually talked to Dick Cheney. I had asked Dick Cheney about the briefing. Who cares what you see or what you think? I asked him, at any point in your career, Mr. Cheney, have you ever been briefed on the subject of UFOs? If so, when was it, and what were you told? And that's when he said, if I had been briefed on that subject, it would probably be classified and I wouldn't be talking about it. So I had that moment. Then I had the moment where I recovered 1,000 pages of documents between the billionaire Lawrence Rockefeller and the science advisor to President Clinton, which was very dramatic, 1,000 pages of interaction back and forth, talking about UFOs with the White House. So that was the track I was on. And I thought I was getting there, but it was the thing I knew the president knew, but he wasn't really going to tell you anything. And I just figured, well, it's just the next document or whatever. In 2012, I'm at a conference in Phoenix, Arizona, and I'm one of the people that was lecturing is Colin Anders, who's the most famous guy for crop circles. Mm-hmm. I have no interest in crop circles whatsoever. And it was their long days, start at 8 o'clock in the morning till 11 at night. So you don't go to every lecture. And it was one of those lectures where I said, yeah, I don't know, I'm not interested in crop circles. Maybe I'll go for lunch, maybe I'll go to the library across the river. And then I thought, nah, he's a major figure. I should go and pay him respect and go watch him lecture. So I'm in there, and it was the old thing. It's my theory is it's all got to do with the ego mind. Shut down your left brain, and you tap in. You get the password, and suddenly you're in the other side. So I'm sitting there. I'm not really paying attention. I'm sort of listening to him, and I'm zoning out. And all of a sudden, three pieces were put together in my head. Just boom, boom, boom. All put together with absolute certainty, which I always tell people, this is the most important part. It just came with absolute certainty. You don't have to check this. You don't have to look. This is how it works. It was just, I was, for 2 days, my head was spinning. And one was this, there are pieces that I'd put together myself, but what it did was put all the pieces together and say, here's how it all fits together. So the one was that top secret memo, the fact that mental phenomena had been mentioned. The second, we had chased around when we chased the Canadian government, we were trying to find out where they got the material for the top secret memo, and it tracked back to the former president of Penn State University, who had 14 honorary doctorate degrees, who was chairman of the board of the Institute for Defense Analysis, where DARPA and JASIN and all these elite groups came out of. And during one conversation, we were talking to him, and he basically said, I can't talk about this because it's classified. He said, I can't talk about it. Go research something else. You're up against the windmill. You're wasting your time. Unless you've got the mind of Einstein, you're not going to figure out anything. And people just kept asking him questions and sending him letters. And at one point, somebody's asking about the control group. Is there a control group? Is it still 12 people? Is it all Americans? And that's when he said, let me ask you a question. What do you know about ESP? And the guy from Great Britain who was interviewing had no idea. And so Walker answers his own question. He said, look, unless you understand about ESP and how it works, you will not be taken in by the control group. Very few people understand how it works. That was 1991. And until I had that download in 2012, I had no idea what he was talking about. As soon as that download, oh, that's what he's talking about. And the third one, the third piece of the puzzle was Ben Rich, who was the head of Lockheed Skunk Works, who 2 years later, Walker was 1991. 2 years later, he's giving a lecture to the engineering alumni at UCLA. The last slide he shows is a flying saucer, and he makes this joke. He says, we've now got the technology to take ET home. Everybody laughs. People start asking questions after, and he gets into the fact that we've discovered the mistake in the equation. It's not going to take a lifetime to do, but it's going to take an act of God to get this thing out of Congress because it's so deep black. One of the people in the room was Jan Hartson, who's now the international director for MUFON, the biggest UFO group in the world. He had an experience when he's 9 years old in the backyard with a flying saucer, like about 30 feet away with his brother. And he became obsessed, like me, with flying saucers. But he was obsessed, became an electrical engineer and wanted to build a flying saucer. So when he was sitting in the room and Ben Rich said, we've got the technology to take ET home, he realized this is my chance. So as Ben Rich is leaving the building, he chases after and he said, Ben, I've been obsessed with UFOs my entire life. I need to know, how do they get here? How does the propulsion system work? And Ben turned around and he said exactly what Walker had said 2 years before. Let me ask you a question. What do you know about ESP? And Jan Hartson didn't know, he didn't expect a question. So he said, it means everything in time and space is connected. And Ben said, that's how it works, and walks out of the building. And so that was the download experience. And then the synchronistic stuff started to happen. I give my first consciousness lecture connected to UFOs. They set me up with this woman by the name of Pam. They say, you still talk to Pam? I go, I guess so. I had no idea who this woman was. She's in her 70s. She comes to this house where I'm staying. She said, what did Stacy say? I said, I don't know. I'm just supposed to talk to you. She comes walking in. She's a remote viewer. She's got works for the government, all this sort of stuff. And you hear all this stuff all the time. And it's like, whatever. Mm-hmm. And then she says to me, she's talking. She says, oh, man, I was flying the craft last night. And I went, you were what? And she said, I was flying the craft. I said, you're flying the flying saucer? And she said, yeah, I've flown three different models. And I go, so how do you fly a flying saucer? And she said, you do it with your mind. And from that point, as soon as that happened, she told me that I had 36 people within a year, people that I had looked up, I'd found the material, or I had actually talked to them. They would say, like women, you know, some woman would say, you know, I was flying the ship, and I'd go, hang on, how do you fly a ship? Nobody out of those 36 people said anything different. Everybody says the same thing. You fly it with your mind. You become one with the craft. You put your hand on this pad. You become one with the craft. The craft is alive, and you can basically think where you want to go, and you actually go there. And so that just revolutionized my thinking. That's where the thing lay. And now there's actually, if you're following the UFO thing, there's this Tom DeLonge, famous rock star guy, who claims he's got 10 high-level sources, including John Podesta, who's Hillary Clinton's campaign manager, generals from, and these people were all confirmed in the WikiLeaks emails. And one of them was Robert Weiss, who's the present head of Lockheed Skunk Works. And Tom DeLonge talks about being at Lockheed Skunk Works, talking to Weiss and the head scientist. And the head scientist said, how do you think to get here? And DeLonge gave an idea, and he said, that's a pretty good idea. Anything else? And he said, I think consciousness is involved. And he said, now you're talking. And DeLonge said, when he brought up consciousness, that's all the head scientist wanted to talk about, was consciousness.
Yeah. Okay. Now, when you say you had a download, is it that you feel someone from the outside gave you information, or do you feel like you just subconsciously put it all together?
Well, I just moved into that field. There's experiments that were done with LSD. If you follow the LSD experiments that were done in Menlo Park in 1967, it's basically the same thing. they had this experiment where you, if you had a if you're a scientist, engineer, or architect, in order to get into the experiment, you had to have a problem that you'd been working on for 3 months, and you could not solve the problem, and you had to prove that you had this problem that you're trying to solve. And then what they would do is they would give there was 48 scientists and engineers and architects. They would give them LSD, they'd put the headphones on, they'd put the eye patches, lay them down, and within seconds, 44 or 48 had the answer. So it's the whole thing with me. It wasn't that there was anything new. I wasn't given anything new. It was just it put the pieces together. I was in that other thing where I wasn't, my rational analytical mind wasn't working. It just relaxed. And so I actually wrote a book later on that dealt with this, because when I had the download experience, I said, well, somebody else got to have a download experience. And the first one I came across was Paul McCartney, who got the song Yesterday in a Dream. And then I suddenly realized there was like 150. I got 150 people who got songs in dreams, spontaneous songs, 12 Nobel Prizes where people think, oh, you know, people rationalize this. Einstein had the dream that he said, it was a dream I knew I had to understand. And I could say that my entire career was based on a meditation upon a dream. The idea of the quantum atom came through a dream. The hologram came on a guy sitting on a park bench, same as me. He'd done all the work. Then he's sitting on the park bench and all of a sudden, boom, it all just comes together in his head. Or the hologram what was the other one? The laser was the other one that was, and they've actually made the park bench into a historic place where the guy was sitting on the park bench and he had gone through all the work, and then you relax the mind and whatever happens, it just puts it all together and puts all the pieces, and you just get this aha moment, which even people like, there's even a video of Feynman and Hoyle talking about this, Feynman talking about the moment of discovery, where he makes this massive discovery, and he said, you can remember the color of the paper and where you were sitting. And he said he tried to recreate it after that. He just couldn't get the mechanism, but he said it just came with this absolute certainty that you know the answer is right. You don't have to figure it out. It just sort of is put together in some other state. You're not in a sort of a conscious left brain state. You shut that left brain down. And that's what I found with inspiration, was whatever the inspiration is, it's being able to shut the ego mind down, whether it's remote viewing or even mediums. A lot of mediums have childhood abuse issues where you're able to dissociate as a child and suddenly you pop over into that world. So to me, that's what it is. It's not that you have any talent. It's the ability to move out of this world, the physical world dominated by the left brain, and pop in, get the password or hack the computer, whatever you want to call it, get in there and pull that stuff back. And some people are better to stay over there. For example, savants, most savants, these people who can do these mathematical calculations in their head, you know, and they can't button their shirts or can, you know, play music in any key and any rhythm and stuff like that. These people all have left brain damage. So they're basically, they're in that world almost all the time. They're living in that sort of world where, you know, all the answers exist. So it's basically the idea that everything is there. Everything is consciousness. And it's the ability to get out of the sort of the local consciousness and experience non-local consciousness. For example, of these experiences, 4,000 experiences, of the people that answered these questions, the 675 questions that answered the particular question, 40% of all experiencers say at some point during their experience, their abduction experience or interaction with aliens, they knew the answer to everything in the universe. That's not something you're going to make up. That's something which they actually experienced. They were over there, they had access to all that material, and then as they came back, all they can remember is that they had access to it at some point, and they slide back into the left brain world of the physical world, and they forget all that kind of stuff, almost like a dream disappearing.
Yeah. So when I was reading the Charlie Red Star book, what kept coming to mind is how much these appearances seem like they are plasma based, like whatever the mechanism behind it is manifesting with some form of plasma. Does that make sense to what you saw?
For ours was plasma. The one I saw on the bridge was a plasma type object, very, very bright. You couldn't really see the edges of it. Same with the Charlie Red Star thing. But in other literature, people are seeing very physical, solid items. So it's almost like they can manifest anything they want. For example, I tell the story of John Lennon. John Lennon sees the UFO with May Pang, his girlfriend, and he's so close to get hit with a brick, and it's got light bulbs. He's got these sort of big light bulbs around it and a red light on the top. And so the question is, why does it have lights on it? Do you need big marquee light bulbs to fly through time and space?
Right.
And the whole idea is, why do UFOs have lights on it? So you can see it. It's almost like they change shapes. For example, in the 1890s, there was all these ships on the western United States, the big airship.
Right,
thing where
right.
for years, and they were wooden ships with propellers. And then it goes to 1940, the war with my father in the war. It was these Foo Fighters that would appear on the edges of the plane. Then it turns into green fireballs in the 1948. Then it turns to these Adamski type crafts with balls underneath it. And then it goes to flying saucers. And now the predominant one is seen as triangles. So you have this progression. It's always the same thing. So I say, well, what happened to the Foo Fighters? Well, they're back on another planet. That's 100 years behind us, and it's almost like they're going through this pattern. And that's why I say to people, it's not the same thing all the time. The beings are changed. There was no grays before 1960. All the human type ones seem to have disappeared. There's all these different patterns, as if they're going through these patterns. And one of the theories that's now out is that we play a large part in what we see. We're mm-hmm. manifesting this, that we're playing part of this thing. So there's even the idea now that whatever alien you see, whatever type of alien, whether it's a gray or an angelic type or a reptilian or whatever, it's based upon what you're projecting. So there's even the story told by Michael Talbot, who wrote The Holographic Universe, and he describes this phenomena. So he's talking about he's an experiencer. He's confirmed experiencer, was under Bud Hopkins, didn't made it public during his life, but he talked about having these poltergeist experiences when he, up till the time he was about 22 years old. And he said quite clearly on tape that when he was in a good mood, the poltergeist would play around, hang his socks off the plants and stuff. But when he was in a bad mood, the poltergeist would stick pins in him and cut him and stuff like this. And that's that whole idea that we are maybe the whole thing. We are manifesting the whole thing, that we sort of say that there's consciousness out there and then there's the physical world, and no, consciousness creates the physical world. Consciousness is primary. That's my conclusion after 42 years. And so we have to get more into looking how much is our mind determining what we see. Because I mean, if you see a UFO, and you're part of the game, because when they abduct people, you don't see the UFO. So therefore, when you see it, you're meant to see it. They want you to see it, and therefore you're part of the game. And all UFOs all seem to have different lights on them, different structures. And why wouldn't they all be the same? It's almost like there's no two UFOs that really look the same. They all have a little bit different lighting structure on them, and it's almost like the person is playing a big part. Or that some of the theory is that people under aggression will say, I'm the one that sent the UFO. That it was me that sent the UFO to wake myself up. That maybe you were even the alien. It gets much more complex than just ETs out there. A lot of the UFO community is starting to move. Jacques Vallée was the first to make this move. And he said, I'd be very surprised if this turns out to be ETs in spacecraft. And I thought he was nuts in the 70s. And I am right there, even maybe farther than Jacques Vallée now, in saying this is going to be a lot less physical than people think it is, and it's going to be a lot more spiritual than people think it is. It is not going to be ETs. It's going to be something a little more, I like to use the word ultra-terrestrial. It's more, it involves consciousness, multi-dimensions. They seem to be in this other world where they're in sort of a dream world, and they can come into the physical world and go back again, and we think we're stuck in the physical world. So it's very, very complex. And one of the briefers at the CIA, who was a briefer for the president, had an experience in the early 1990s. He went to the CIA to get an explanation. They said, you don't want to know about this. And they briefed him on the whole situation after he retired. But what he said about his experience, he had the beings in the room. And this is a guy who briefed the president. He had the beings in his room, and he's gone public with this, with his wife. And he said, it shattered my understanding of reality. And he said, the idea that you can measure this thing, that's scientific, we're going to measure taste, feel, you know, all this kind of
right,
stuff.
Right.
He said, the idea you can measure this, his words, is laughable. How do you define something where there does not appear to be any there? This has got to do with consciousness. This has got to do with multi-dimensions. This is a guy, high-level CIA guy, and that's the way I describe it. So when he said that, I go, he's right on the mark. This is going to be a lot less physical than people think it is.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I noticed in the book you had comment that you thought Vallée was off on the multidimensional thing. I was wondering if your stance on that had changed much
Yeah, well, whether it's multidimensional or the way I look at it now is that it's all consciousness. So there is no levels. Once you put a noun on it, you're making a mistake. It's all one thing. It's like water. The you go up through the water, it gets brighter, you get closer, but there are no real levels. It's all consciousness, structured as physical universe, this dimension, that dimension. But there is no, it's all the same thing. It's all consciousness.
Right, right. In one of the stories, you talked about Sasquatch being associated with one of the sightings. Now, do you think that's connected to the same type of thing?
Oh, absolutely. And that was the main reason why people will say, you know, they're up in the hiding in the northwest of the United States in the trees. And there's absolutely no way, because where I live, we have this joke. I mean, you can let your dog go and watch him run away for days. I mean, it is absolutely flat and there are no trees. In this area where this thing happened, you'll have tree belts where people grow trees to stop the snow in the winter or whatever. But where this incident happened, where it was south of an Air Force base, maybe 20 miles north of Carmen, they reported the Sasquatch, and there was lots of witnesses, and they had the footprints, and the Aboriginal tracker who tracked this thing took me along the river, and he showed me the broken branches as this thing went into this clearing. And it went into the clearing, and he was a heavy guy, 250 pounds. And he said he didn't break through the snow, but this thing was breaking through the snow. So it was very heavy. And it went into the clearing, and that's where it stopped. And so the idea that I got immediately was it was picked up, that it was pulled out. So the idea that there's a Sasquatch hiding in Manitoba, nobody in Manitoba would ever believe that, because there's just no place to hide. There's like 10 trees and this thing's like 9 feet high. So it made very much sense that this is a sort of a spinoff of the UFO phenomena, because this is where the 32 horses disappeared, near where that Sasquatch happened. There was lots of stuff happening in that area. And it was only the one Sasquatch sighting that I had in that area, but it was very revealing, because there was this bunch of trees, but that was it. Other than those trees, it was just for miles and as flat as you could get it. No hills, no place to hide.
Okay, where do you see yourself going forward from here?
To me, it's all still in the consciousness realm, in dealing with, I've gotten dragged into, my whole career is being dragged in. I got dragged into the music thing. I do the music thing. I got phoned by an experiencer that told me the message is in the music. And I went, whatever. I mean, you're talking to the wrong guy. I don't listen to music. I can't play music. I have no interest in music, whatever. And then he mentioned that Neil Young was one of the songs called After the Gold Rush, which is, you see the lyrics, it's basically the experiencer lyrics, where we're destroying the world, and this flying saucers are going to come and take people off the planet, and we're just destroying the whole place. And the thing was, Neil Young was born in my, grew up in my city. And that's what dragged me down that rabbit hole. And then suddenly I got this bizarre connection that at one point I thought they had every single musician. It was just bizarre how many major musicians write about UFOs are claiming to be experiencers, or John Denver claiming to be from the constellation Lyra, and all these different bizarre things. So I've just sort of let myself flow. But to me, consciousness is the bottom line to this thing. And the book that I'm planning to do is dealing with mistakes that we make, and I called it the UFO equation. So it's like when you do your math in high school, where you got to show your work so that they can see you added here instead of subtracting. And it's these kind of things that we've done that we make mistakes. For example, is the world consciousness based or is it physical based? And so I have these 24 things came to me almost instantaneously. I'm walking down a road. These things, this is this, or this, or this, and you're making these mistakes. So we if you assume it's a physical world, I maintain you're never going to solve the equation, because you've made a fundamental mistake. Or is the world random or is it patterned? These kind of things. And light versus darkness, and these 24 things. So this is the one I want to work on. But it still goes back to what is reality. And that's basically what happens. We sort of laugh in ufology. People think when you go to a UFO conference, people are sitting there talking about flying saucers. Nobody ever talks about flying saucers. Within 5 minutes, the conversation is on consciousness, God, reality. It mm-hmm. moves back. Nobody ever talks about flying saucers. Never. Nobody. It's just bizarre how so that's what it is. It goes down to this: what is reality? And the same with the paranormal phenomena. All the stuff I say, it's all the same thing. It's just parsing, whether it's remote viewing, psychic phenomena, poltergeist, all this kind of stuff. It's all consciousness. It's all outside that physical parameter where we're getting into that other part of consciousness, where it's sort of popping through. And it, to me, it's all the same thing. And that's what the CIA calls it. The CIA calls it phenomenology. It's all the same thing.
I've been saying pretty much since I started this show that the answers lie in redefining what we mean as reality.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Like, we don't understand what reality is. We don't understand what consciousness is. And it's the interplay between these things that this stuff seems to exist in. And so we're asking the wrong questions when we're trying to break it down in a material sense.
Yeah, yeah. And we make these assumptions, and then you can't move people off these beliefs that they have. And it's all belief. That's the other thing I've sort of concluded. Like, people always give me the thing, I know and you believe. No. It's all belief, man. Don't go with the I know. The only people that really know, because I did, the one thing I believe is very closely connected to this is lucid dreaming. Lucid dreaming is very mm-hmm. close to what these guys are. And if you look at the work that was done at Stanford University by Stephen LaBerge, they do the reality checks. And I had these because I was trying to do lucid dreaming. So you have your cell phone and you have these little apps that go off every 30 minutes. And what do you do to check reality? You count your fingers. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, pull your finger. Does it get longer or whatever? And that's reality. It's, people think that reality is out there, and they don't realize that it's basically experience. And even then, it might not be real. I mean, the world could have started 3 minutes and 15 seconds ago, complete with fossils and memories. It's so uncertain. And that's what we've come to realize in the UFO community is that, because I do the paranormal phenomena as well, is that when you start getting into this thing, you realize, like, we aren't even close to understanding what's going on. We a lot of people will name things, or it's called naming theory. So you say, oh, it's just, the body just cell reproduces. And it's like, okay, fine. It's a nice little trick. Now explain the trick. You're just, or in science, people describe and they say they're explaining. Science doesn't explain anything. It just describes things.
Right.
The actual operation, we really don't know. So these 24 things, I want to sort of set them out in a book. And these are the assumptions that we're making, that because you hold these beliefs fast, you don't really check your work. And you keep doing the same calculation over and over again, and you still make the same. You added when you're supposed to subtract. And it's to set these 24 things that, and this was a download I got as well. I remember exactly what street it was, when it came. I'm sitting there, and it's cold here, and I'm trying to write on this piece of paper, and I'm trying to get all this stuff down, and I've got the outline. But I always say, like Wayne Dyer, you say thank you 3 times every day. Because the way I look at it, whether it's the UFO phenomena or paranormal, or that you and I think are in the same sort of ballpark, is that we could have been, I always tell people, you could be picked as an untouchable in the streets of Calcutta and spend your days looking for something valuable enough to sell, to buy food for tomorrow. You didn't. You got to play in this unbelievable Super Bowl of all stories. If you understand what's going on, you realize this is the most important story of all times, whether it's paranormal phenomena, this reality thing, what's this all about? And I feel honored every day to have been able to play in this game.
I would agree with that wholeheartedly. I think that the understanding this tells us a lot about everything that we are and why we're here.
Exactly. Exactly.
Where can people find you online?
I have my website, presidentialufo.com, but I don't really post much because I don't do much for presidents. I have a YouTube site now that I'm starting to post shorter little things, 10-minute things, where I do a question, because what I found is I do a lot of 2-hour interviews and lectures and stuff, but the attention span of most people, in especially in the young generation, is like 10 minutes. So mm-hmm. I have a YouTube channel called White House UFO, and we are putting very short pieces on different questions, different things. And I think that's where I'll spend most of my time on. But I do have the president's site, which you can go and see which presidents saw UFOs, which ones talked about UFOs, where the documents are, all this kind of stuff. But I really don't maintain it that much anymore.
Do you have any conferences or anything coming up?
I'm being in Great Britain twice, and I'm doing Cleveland in 2 weeks. I'm doing Minnesota this weekend. I really don't do that much traveling because I was refused entry to the United States for a visa thing over $150 honorarium. So I really don't do that much traveling because you can't really take an honorarium. You can't sell books. You can't do anything. So I basically do it on my own time, which is okay. But, after a while, it gets a little tiresome. So that's where I'm going to the YouTube thing, where I can put it out and put a lot out all at one time. And so that's the road I'm going to go. And that seems to be what people want to do, is they don't really want to read books that much anymore. Everybody's on YouTube. Everybody's got these sort of things. So I take some of the real hot button issues, like, you know, are aliens communists? And I'll talk 10 minutes about whether aliens are communists and upset everybody and that kind of stuff. And they are communists. They are.
Do you have a Facebook presence as well?
I have a Facebook presence, Presidential UFO at Facebook. But I sometimes don't post that much on Facebook because I there's this negative trolling stuff that goes on Facebook. It's like, yeah, just annoying. And that's one of the things I was even telling people. I'm going to quit the field. I'm getting out of here because it's just such this negative vibration. The conspiracy has sort of taken over, the conspiracy stuff inside the UFO community. And they've just sort of changed the noun. It's like, you know, we have this evil, because I always fight with people about the idea of evil. No, this evil is nonsense, crazy. There are no evil Jews. There are no, you know, there's nobody to put in the gas chamber. And what they're saying is, you know, there's evil aliens and there's the evil government, and everybody in the government gets up every day and tries to figure out how to destroy the world. And I'm going, like, I deal with these people. No, I don't think so. So, but I, that kind of negative energy, it just sort of drags me down. I just, for some reason, I have to sort of move away from it. So I don't really do that much Facebook anymore. I'll post stuff on Facebook, but I really won't watch what people say.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes that's the best way. So the next thing will probably be this book with the different assumptions.
Yeah, with that. And then I got sort of dragged again. I got dragged in two weeks ago. I was in San Francisco. I was at Mount Shasta. There's this incident there where this alien kept appearing in the bush. And then I got a message supposedly from this alien that he knew I was coming, and this UFO appeared. So I went and interviewed all these people, and it was absolutely stunning that these people all confirmed, yeah, this 10-foot guy was standing in the bush, and they're all Latino people. They come to America. There's like 130 of them. And I did interviews of one incident. It was nine witnesses to this event where this landing thing took place, and they went into the bush and through this Zendra portal type thing. And I was just floored. I thought, holy man, I got to do this story, because nobody, it's almost like the Carmen thing. It's like, why is nobody doing this story? Because this appeared numerous times. And so that'll be a quick book. But the one where you get into reality and that sort of stuff, that really interests me, because it really makes you think. And that's what the bottom line. It's consciousness. It's reality. It's where I'm really honored to be a part of this, because it makes you think, because that was my whole thing. I've been fascinated with death my whole life. I've been fascinated with what's it all about. And I always tell people, you really don't have to worry, because people are always into conspiracy, what everybody else is doing, what the government's doing. I say, you only have one thing to worry about. If you believe in reincarnation, everything changes. If reincarnation is a fact, then you agreed to come here to do something, and at some point you're going to leave, and they're going to say, so how did you make out? Because you put the play together. The only thing you have to worry about is, what did I come here to do? Forget about everybody else. Forget about what's going on. What did I come here to do? So I always try to remind myself every day, stick where you are, stick what you came here to do, and forget about everything else.
All right. Well, Grant, thank you for spending some time with us. It's been a pleasure talking to you about this. I would love to have you back when you get your next book out. Either one, actually. I'd like to hear about this Mount Shasta thing. And definitely when you have the consciousness book out, that would be great to have you back.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Maybe I'll send you a copy of my Inspired book, because that was one of the ones where it gets into this this reality and where thought comes from and where stuff's coming. That was kind of a unique book that I did. So we'll be in touch. And again, I appreciate it. I've followed your show. The way I do most of my research is that I'll take a show like yours, and I haven't done yours for about a year, but what I'll do is, you have so many good shows that on an MP3 player, I'll download 20 hours. And then I don't really watch TV or anything. And I just listen to show after show after show. So you're helping educate me, and that's, you know, helping me figure the stuff. It's a lot faster than reading. It's a lot faster than going to lectures, and people should do more of this. It's just download all these shows and just listen. And you're in a sort of a quiet state where you're walking around or you're doing something, and all these ideas are going into your head. So that's how I do most of my research, is following people like you.
Awesome. Awesome. Books are available where?
Amazon is probably the best place to go.
Okay. Thank you so much, Grant.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right. I hope you enjoyed that. If you're a musician and you have music you'd like me to end the show with, put in the outro here, you can contact me at contact@wheredidtheroadgo.com, or just send along some music and tell me where I can tell people to point you. Point them? Yeah, point them makes more sense, huh? All right. So to find more of your stuff. Anyway, that's contact at wheretotheroadgo.com. Tonight we're going to end with one of my favorites. This is Elisa Rickman, and she is doing a video for this song. It's called Pretty Little Head, and you can find her on Bandcamp, amongst other places. Enjoy.
Dirty mouth, pretty little head.